and welcome to the latest Fraser of Allender podcast. Loyal listeners will know that we've been doing a series of interviews with former staff of the Institute, particularly focusing on some of the people who've led the Institute over the years. I'm delighted to say that joining me today is a former member of the Institute who was around, as far as I can tell, at the very start of the Institute in 1975. Professor David Bell. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Mary.
Now, the sorts of people who listen to our podcast, David, I'm sure will be familiar with you, a legend in Scottish economics that you are. But for those who aren't, if you could just say a little bit about yourself, your sort of journey into economics, and how you ended up at the FAI.
Thanks, Mary. So I was brought up in Dornoch in Sutherland, which is now where I currently am. And in school, I actually focused on maths and physics. And when I went to university, that was my intention, was to do maths and physics. But I had a hankering for something different, so I opted to do those subjects in the arts faculty, which was possible in Aberdeen at that time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Physics was natural philosophy at the time. And a friend recommended me that I do this other subject called political economy, which I'd never previously studied. So I ended up actually doing a degree in economics and statistics at Aberdeen. And after that, I went to the London School of Economics, where I did the master's degree in econometrics and mathematical economics, which was a very intensive year, I've got to say. There's a very famous statistic in time series analysis called the Durbin-Watson statistic. And we had Durbin in one term and Watson in the following term. So we...
That's impressive.
So after that, I wanted to get back to Scotland, and actually there was a vacancy in the statistics department at St Andrews, and I went to St Andrews and spent a happy year there, but their main interest was in ecological, environmental statistics, which wasn't my field at all. And so I heard, I can't remember how, on the grapevine that this new institute was being set up at Strathclyde. So in 1975, I joined, and the people there then were David Simpson, Jim McGilvray, and Ian McNichol, and not forgetting Isabel, the secretary.
Oh, no, we can't forget Isabel. She's come up in every discussion we've had.
So, and we moved into Cathedral Street in the converted library, I think it was, on something like the fifth floor. And that's where we started, I guess.
That's great, David. So that's how you ended up there. But what are your memories of that early days, those early days as the Institute was being established? And what was your role in establishing the Institute and the first sorts of outputs it was producing?
So in a way, I was, I guess, slightly different from David, Jim and Ian in that they all had a grounding in input-output analysis. And my interest was in econometrics and in econometric modelling. And I was eventually going to do a PhD in Strathclyde, which was about regional econometric modelling. So while the others concentrated on building an input-output model for Scotland, along with the Scottish executive people, I guess, at that time, I ended up doing the rest, which involved effectively setting up the commentary kind of keeping up to date with the statistical base. Was relatively sparse at that time, but there had been no significant regular publications prior to the commentary, which focused on the Scottish economy and its future prospects.
Yes, and we've got, you know, the original commentary that was published. The first one was in July 1975. So yeah, it's really quite fun to look back at the issues that were being discussed then. In some ways, the issues seem the same, and obviously, and in some ways, they're very different, because the economy's very different. So how long were you at Strathclyde and as part of the Institute, David, before you moved on to your next challenge?
So I was there until 1980, I think, before I joined what was called the Macroeconomic Modelling Bureau at the University of Warwick. So I was still retaining a focus on macroeconomic, or sorry, on econometric modelling. One of the reasons that I got the job, though, was that I actually managed to link the computer at Strathclyde with the computer at Warwick, and send, I can't remember, send some files across. This was prior to the internet being invented and involved masses of obscure commands to the two computers, and that convinced the director of the Macroeconomic Modelling Bureau, Ken Wallace, that I was vaguely competent.
It's interesting, actually. I think there's a theme in some of these discussions you're having about you all hiding your light under bushels, I would say. But just for younger listeners, what does it mean to say, you're talking about using the computer at Strathclyde and linking it to, you mentioned obviously the internet didn't exist at that point. What practically was it like using that sort of technology in the late 70s?
So I remember I had to go across to the main building in Strathclyde to use the computer at all. And there were these huge card punch machines. And basically, I think I was programming in Fortran at that time. So you had basically one line of code was one card. What you really didn't want to do was to mix up the cards, because obviously they had to be in the right order. And if you dropped them, we used elastic bands to hold the programs together. But if you dropped them, that was a disaster. And then you handed them in, and there was a huge machine. I think actually it was initially an ICL computer, which in which your program was fed along with many others. And then you got these massive printouts, which were like way bigger than A4, folded paper, and very simple alphanumeric printing on them. So you had to make some sense of what it was you got out, given what you'd put in, and it was challenging, let us say, compared with computing nowadays.
Yeah, I think anyone who's done any sort of programming in R or Stata or whatever to analyze a data set, like the way that you can run it, there's an error, I'll fix it, run it, like the process back then would have been very different if you discovered you'd made an error somewhere.
I mean, just one letter in the wrong place on a card within your deck was enough to throw the whole thing out. And of course, you'd had to join the queue again at the back of the queue. So it was all it was challenging.
So from your time at the FAI, obviously established in 1975, I think that the I/O tables were published maybe in 78 or made available at that sort of time, and the commentary was published all through those early years. Are there particular things that you remember or stand out apart from the massive computer, of course, and the punch cards that you're proud of, or you think were good things that the Institute did in its early days that you were part of?
Well, I mean, I think we did draw attention fairly quickly to the activities of the Institute. The publication, sorry, the publicity that the commentary got was beneficial for the Institute itself, but also for the university. You know, it was a sort of little badge of honour for the university to be quoted so much in relation to the concerns of the day. And of course, the concerns of the day, we were just coming out of pretty serious inflation. We were going into the winter of discontent. There were all kinds of things going on which were challenging for the economy at that time. And then, of course, towards the end of my period, Mrs. Thatcher was elected.
Of course,
with quite a different agenda. So I think when I started, manufacturing accounted for about a third of the Scottish workforce, and now it's something like 5% or thereabouts. Not
yeah,
much
the
more.
Workforce, yeah. Yeah, about 10% of the economy, but yeah, that's not much more productive than other sectors. So
So I mean, that was the start of the sort of deindustrialization period, and a massive change which took place over in the Scottish economy. Of course, another thing that was happening was that the workforce was becoming more educated. When I went to university, around 5% of people went to university. And now it's around, it's over, hovering around 40-41%. So again, a massive change was societal change was taking place.
Yeah, absolutely. When I went to university in the sort of the Blair years, obviously, and that was when the UK government were saying they wanted, was it half of people or something to go to university, which has had its own legacy. I think you've written a lot on things like underemployment, for example. But yeah, it'd be interesting how much that's changed. Although I will say, having gone to study maths and statistics at St Andrews, so they're still very focused on environmental and ecological.
Oh, really?
Yes, it's very much still their specialism, which is interesting. So some things change and some things don't. You left the FEI in 1980, and I first met you, David, when you were Professor of Economics at Stirling University, I think, was when we first came across each other. So you've watched the kind of institute evolve and change over the years from afar. Have you any reflections over the sorts of things the Institute has done over those years? I mean, did you keep in touch with people and the sort of outputs the Institute was producing?
Yeah, so I do keep in touch with people. I mean, there were people who passed through during my time there that I still keep in touch with, like Andrew Oswald, Alan Carruth, Frank Kerwin was at the Institute then. Frank Harrigan, but I haven't been in touch with for a long time. And also, while I was there, George Lowenstein passed through as a visiting scholar. He's a very famous behavioral economist. A lot of interesting people passed through the Institute while I was there. Then post then, so I came back to Glasgow before I went on to Stirling. So I spent a few years teaching in Glasgow. And I always kept an interest in what was going on. And, I think the Institute has flourished. We've had a variety of directors, obviously yourself, very notably. I know Graham. I still keep very much in touch with Graham Roy, who's a big figure on in the Scottish economic scene. So, I mean, it seems to me that the Institute is the number one place within Scotland for objective advice about what's going on, and that now covers a much wider range of economics related subjects. Because another thing that has happened since I started studying economics is that it has become pervasive. People have understood that economics can be applied to many, many different areas. Actually, when I was in Stirling, I taught the economics of sport, which in itself is a fascinating year. But I mean, economics has undermined quite a lot of subjects who thought they had the world to themselves, like education, like health, and the perspective of economists has had a very marked effect on those disciplines, and Fraser Institute has played an important role within Scotland and indeed outside Scotland in relation to those.
No, absolutely. And, one of the things we're trying to do through various bits of work that we're doing is to sort of demonstrate, what you've said, which is that these tools that we develop and use can bring insights to lots of different issues. And really it's about thinking about things in an analytical way and using the best data and modelling and all these things to bring insights. And you can do that to pretty much any area. We've obviously specialised in recent years and quite a lot of social policy issues, but we're also doing quite a lot on things like trade and other things. So it's yeah, it's quite a variety that we work on, sometimes driven by the excellent people we've been able to bring in and sometimes driven by things like great funding opportunities, such as our Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, for example. So you can sort of drive it and be driven a little bit by events and what's most impactful. And we always want to make sure we're talking about the things that actually are going to resonate in the public debate, I suppose.
And it's interesting that some of these tools are actually quite simple, but well, it may be a appear simple to you and me. I used to do the fast stream interviews for the civil service, and I remember being advised that candidates who understood the concept of opportunity cost had a big advantage over those that didn't. And it's not really too difficult a concept, but it does take you a long, long way, and sometimes it's something that people in public bodies struggle with for reasons I don't fully understand.
No, I think that's fair. I can't tell you how many times every week that I use that phrase, opportunity cost. And quite often, as you say, it can be in the context of something like government spending, where there can be the focus on whether this element of spending, this pot of spending, will have an impact of some kind, and how to quantify that. But that isn't the important question, is it? It's not whether it has an impact, it's whether it's the best way to spend limited resources to get the maximum impact we can on the outcomes we want to achieve, and the best value for the public purse. So that's the, it's the wrong question asking if spending money has an impact, because it always will in some way, but it's whether it's the most efficient way to do it, and the most efficient way to use very limited resources.
I mean, there is a thing there. So, British economics, in my opinion, was actually going down a rabbit hole when I was being taught, because I was taught time series analysis in LSE when I was there, which has very limited applicability now. Well, it has some applicability, but it is not at the forefront of economics research now. And much, much more effort is directed towards evaluation and understanding causal impacts. And a lot of that is to do with what we call natural experiments. And most of that work really came from the US, associated with people like Heckman. And people later on, but I think those of us who were taught at my time kind of were going in the wrong direction. Well, in what appears at currently to be the wrong direction as far as understanding the full the full breadth of the potential application of economic techniques.
Yeah, that's fair, and it is really interesting. Some of the work we do to try and evaluate policy interventions, we would do these sort of what we call, you know, these quasi-experimental methods where you're exploiting these natural experiments. And in the public policy sphere, it can often be quite challenging to get the data you require to be able to do this properly. Anyone who's interested can look at our report on the small business bonus scheme, for example, which was a form of quasi-experimental methods. Very difficult, given data challenges. And some of the work we've been doing recently, actually, with third sector delivery bodies, is just how challenging it is for them to either have the resources or the analytical capacity to design monitoring so that evaluation can be done properly for us, really, to understand the value of the public money that's being spent, which I think is sort of a real challenge. And I know it can be challenging for, you know, the public sector to think about putting aside this money to ensure that this is done properly. But if we don't do it, then we're never going to know what really works and what's most effective.
If I had one frustration with Scottish Government over the years, is its lack of willingness to engage with the idea of proper evaluation and putting aside sufficient resource to design evaluation exercises properly, and to after the event ex ante carry out a proper evaluation. And I've been to the States and been involved in these kinds of discussion about social policy, and it's just accepted there. That's what you do. I think it's accepted south of the border as well. That's what you do. You do a proper evaluation if you want to see whether a policy has been effective. And I think far too often we seem to design policies that have a multiplicity of objectives, and the lack of clarity of how on earth you assess whether they're working or not is really a problem.
Yeah, it's a sort of combination, isn't it, of and we've said this, you know, several times publicly, of the lack of acknowledgement of trade-offs. You know, you're pursuing one thing for a particular aim which might have an impact on other objectives you have, but, you know, you accept that and acknowledge it, which isn't sort of flushed out, because quite often policies aren't appraised in quite a kind of structured way to look at all the different options. And then, you know, not really wanting to know if things do or don't work because you've done it now.
Yeah.
And, you know, so all of which is not good for the what we would understand to be the sort of policy making cycle of learning from what you've done in the past to ensure that you improve and you spend money in the most efficient way. I don't know if there's a kind of maturity that needs to come in terms of how we do policy making in Scotland. Maybe since devolution and you know, early years of devolution, there was quite a lot of money around in terms of budgets and things. And yeah, it's difficult to know why that kind of culture has developed, but I definitely think it's an issue in Scotland, and particularly accepting that, you know, maybe we can't have a fairer, greener, growing economy with excellent public services all at once, and every policy we do will tick all of those boxes all of the time, because it's just not possible to do that.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, just before I came on, I was looking at the community wealth building policy, and it's exactly that. It's a multiplicity of objectives, and you just don't know. I would be at a complete loss to understand how on earth we evaluate whether public money associated with that policy is being well spent.
I think that's probably fair. And like, I guess one of the frustrations that folks like us might have, I mean, I know you've been working on Scottish economy longer than me, David, but I started working in the Scottish government. actually, 20 years ago this month, I started as a staff.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, it's exactly 50 years ago I started.
So, you know, you can get quite cynical, particularly if you know, you've been sort of hoping this will happen and calling for things for all of your career. It can be quite depressing to see that sort of move on. But just thinking about that evolution, I mean, and thinking back to the 70s and then the various roles that you've had, How has the Scottish economy, or the economy in the UK maybe, evolved in like, completely different ways than was expected, back in the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, well, so we had the deindustrialization, and then the sort of boom in services that took place under Thatcher. We had in Scotland still a large share of inward investment into things like making chips, a silicon chips, I mean, which had a pretty big impact across the Central Belt. But the that kind of petered out as the loss of competitiveness to the Far East kind of materialized. And although we managed, the economy was growing well during the Blair years, there is a question of whether it was being its growth was being exaggerated by the financial sector and what had been going on there. And then you've got 2008, which is, just a milestone, and the slow growth of productivity since then. So Scotland still does get more than its fair share of inward investment, but I think the scale of that is we don't get large investments employing hundreds of people anymore. So we've had this massive shift into services, slow growth in productivity, and people starting to get I think, after I guess 17 years gone since 2008 now, people becoming cynical about the ability of government to improve their basic standard of living. And that's associated with the slow growth in productivity. And I know the Institute has done a lot of work on productivity, but it seems to me to be a very difficult nut to crack at the moment. And that's true for the UK as a whole, as well as in Scotland. So I guess I've gone from a period where there was remarkable change, but people still retained an optimistic outlook, although there was a period where unemployment went very, very high, just after I left, basically, and was down in Warwick. But we're now at a situation where it's not the unemployment rate that really is catching the attention. It's the inactivity rate, particularly inactivity associated with ill health. And that has come as a complete surprise. I did not anticipate that happening. And I've done a lot of work with David Blanchflower, and the who was at Warwick at the same time as I was, and subsequently joined the Monetary Policy Committee and is now at Dartmouth College in the US. But he's done a lot of work recently about declining mental health, especially of young people, and that is an issue that is of real concern, not only in and of itself, but also of the economic implications of it.
No, absolutely. And one of the interesting things about the discussion recently is obviously that the knowledge about really what's happening is quite hampered by the challenges on the labour market data side. To what extent is the inactivity a statistical artifact? Do we really understand this? Obviously, people are linking it to things like the increase in disability-related benefits, but we don't actually know whether those people are employed or not. So how much of this is about in-work poverty or in-work people declaring they have disabilities when maybe they didn't in the past. There are all these interesting things that might be going on, but one of the things that's hampering us a little bit is the quality of the evidence to really be able to pinpoint it, which is difficult for policymakers to then respond, you know, when we don't really know why these things are happening.
So I'm on the ONS advisory group for the labour force survey, and it has gone through horrid times in recent years. Partly the ONS perhaps didn't do enough to keep the sample size up, but also there seems to be a genuine problem, particularly post-pandemic, to engage people with surveys. And this is partly due to the internet now bombarding you with questions about what you think of this product, what you think of that product, and a serious survey that is trying to gather objective data, it is kind of lost in the melee of questions that people are being bombarded with through the internet. And this provides a real challenge. I am actually and I'm sure you are involved in this too, is do we kind of largely give up on surveys and just use techniques like scraping the internet and or a administrative data? So it seems like, at least we know that the tax data is going to be reasonably accurate, doesn't capture everyone, but it does capture, a large proportion of the workforce. So as you say, that on these big issues like inactivity, there's a cloud of uncertainty associated with understanding what is really going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And declaring interest myself, I'm a non-exec director now on the UK Statistics Authority Board, which oversees the ONS, joined earlier this year. Obviously, it has been a torrid time for the organisation, but I think the question that you raise, as somebody who's worked in statistics for a long time, you can see there'll always be a need to ask people how they feel about things, whether they've been looking for work, these sorts of things that you need to actually collect to be able to understand whether someone is actually classified as unemployed or not. But the things that we collect through these, we're probably going to have to collect them in different ways and in shorter surveys, and we have to limit it to those things that we really need to ask people about rather than other things that we could potentially get from administrative data. So we're all going to have to think about how we collect this information in a better way, I think. So we focus on those things we really need to get through surveys.
And there are ethical concerns around that, which are genuine, but do make it very difficult. I was involved in, doing some analysis of multi-morbidity in Scotland. This was just pre-pandemic, and understandably there are lots of concerns about accessing people's health data. It really is a huge challenge. It is extraordinarily difficult to get that kind of access, even though the payoff from good effective studies could be very substantial, because of course health and social care are our biggest spend.
Yeah, and for me, a lot of the assumptions that we use to think about how things might evolve in the future and conversations about fiscal sustainability are actually based on could and should be based on better research about what's happening in the UK and how, how much we spend or use of health services changes by income or age. We need much more and better research on these things for the UK. Yep. But these challenges often mean that researchers would do it on any other country apart from the UK, because the data access challenges are likely to be a little less, which is a challenge in academia. Just to finish off then, David, taking a step back, you're still involved obviously in the Scottish public debate. We were chatting before we started recording about we're both on a parliamentary committee later this week together about social security. What do you see in terms of what would add to the public debate in Scotland over the next few years? Are there other things that you think that the FEI should maybe be doing in terms of its research programme, or maybe others? It would be great to have other independent voices, obviously. Graham and Roy and I have had a similar conversation as part of the series, and he was saying, it would be great obviously to see a richer kind of independent research and think tank environment in Scotland.
There is a huge amount of effort put into researching the political state of Scotland, and it's easy publicity for newspapers to report on that on a regular basis. I'm not entirely sure whether one can reallocating that would be difficult, but there's it seems to me to be a much stronger sort of environment of independent research in London than is the case in Scotland. Actually, I think the private sector is pretty badly represented in Scotland. There are voices that get attention regularly around charities, and of course, our NGOs are not short of their own publicity efforts. But independent research could be much better. Sorry, that's not well. I'm not wanting to take away from the Fraser Institute, but there could be a wider group of institutions that participate in the economic and political process. It seems to me there is an issue of how we make that effective. And I think, to be honest, the Parliament has been disappointing in that respect. Firstly, the committees have not taken on board sufficiently the issues around opportunity cost in general, but also the sort of economic arguments in also. And the strength of the debate about the economy in the Scottish Parliament, I think, is not good. It's weak. Other issues dominate the time and the parliamentary time. And ultimately, standards of living, economic growth, child poverty, all of these things are dependent on having a well-functioning, efficient economy. And it seems to me that the Parliament, sometimes you get the impression that it's not terribly interested.
I wonder if it's linked to the discussion we had earlier about, really being willing to appraise policy properly, so not just looking at, well, if I spend money on this, or if we change this regulation, then it'll have this consequence, but also thinking about all of the unintended consequences that you would identify through structural, more structured appraisal processes. Because to me, that can quite often be the economic discussion we don't have, which is this policy will have this consequence that we intend, but it also might have a investment or economic consequences that we don't intend, but we still need to try and measure what they might be and think about how we could, mitigate or reduce them if we still want to go ahead with the policy. Or you might think, well, those consequences mean that we shouldn't do it. So I agree with you. I think that that might be part of that.
I mean, unintended consequences is a great phrase that we ought to introduce to the lexicon of our parliamentarians. Perhaps only the Finance Committee has asked committees when doing their scrutiny to think about if they were recommending something, what would they recommend be taken away to substitute for that particular additional spending that they're talking about. And the Finance Committee has had many reports, and I guess that there's a problem in that, you know, how does the Scottish Government react to the reports of the committees and the Finance Committee in particular?
It'll be interesting to see, you know, this might not come up during the election campaign at all because it might be too, like, a wonkish point, no offence, David, but, you know, whether the effectiveness of the committee system in Holyrood and, you know, how that could evolve and change in a more mature parliament. You know, I would hope it would be discussed as part of the election campaign, but it might not. But, I mean, I think it is something that many seem to think needs to be kind of looked at and for us to think about again, whether it's been as effective as it could be.
Yeah, I mean, I think the UK Parliament committees, and it's partly because there are a lot of MPs who are perhaps not that, or feel that they're not that likely to get a governmental position, and who are genuinely well informed about whatever committee it is they happen to be on, the cut and thrust in these committees tends to be much more pertinent than is the case with the Scottish committees, unfortunately.
Yeah, I would agree with that, definitely. Listen, David, we're sort of setting the world to rights, which is great. But just thank you so much for your reflections. It's been really interesting to hear your thoughts. This is one of a series of podcasts we're doing with people who were there right at the start of the FAI and then throughout the years. You can see the rest of the pods that we've got on this on our website. And please don't forget to sign up for our conference on the 18th and 19th of September. We are running a bit low on places now, so if you are keen to come, please sign up as soon as possible, because I think we're going to have to start a waiting list soon, but hopefully everyone who wants to come will be able to come along to the conference. It should be a great event. So thank you very much, David, for joining me today, and we'll see you again soon for the next Fraser Valander podcast.
Hello, 2025 marks a significant year for the Fraser Valander Institute. Founded in 1975, the Institute celebrates 50 years of leading economic research in Scotland. Given this, we have a series of exciting events and content planned for the remainder of this year to mark this milestone. This includes our anniversary conference on the 18th and 19th of September this year at the University of Strathclyde's Technology and Innovation Centre. We have a number of speakers and theme sessions planned for the day in order to highlight the breadth and importance of the economic research being conducted across Scotland. As well as this, we have a number of other events planned, including a reception at the Scottish Parliament in December and one at the Scotland office in London in October. You'll also see some unique content published in the coming months, including a podcast series with past Institute directors and some articles in the history of the Institute, as well as some rather eye-catching covers on some of our reports from over the years in the coming months. In order to be kept up to date with any of these events and to be the first to know about our 50th anniversary publications, visit our website, fraservalander.org, and even join our mailing list. If you are interested in engaging with us also, whether you've previously worked for or with the Institute, why not get in touch? We have a designated 50th anniversary email, fraser50@strath.ac.uk. We hope you're as excited as we are and look forward to celebrating this exciting milestone with as many of you as possible.